I will open the Senate Committee on Rules for March 10, 2009, and open public hearings on SB 30, 31, 32. I will also remind the parties in the audience that we have a number of amendments. They have seen some of them before, and there are actually some new amendments. And we're taking testimony both on the original bills and on any of the amendments. It would be helpful at this particular juncture if your testimony, if you came to testify about a particular amendment, that your testimony be focused on that amendment, since it, we are at the stage where we're trying to craft the, basically what will be the final bill that comes from this committee. So I'm going to start off with someone I don't think has spoken before, actually. Is that Mr. Darrell Flood? Please come forward and identify yourself for the record, and if you can just take about 3 or 4 minutes, and we'll go on to the next person.
Darrell Flood, Lafayette, Oregon. Good evening, Senators. My name is Darrell Flood, and I have MS. I have provided a copy of my statement because that's what I mean to say, but it's not what I might actually say. A little of my background. I was a security police officer in the United States Air Force and a reserve deputy for Multnomah County. 2.5 years ago, I was elected mayor of Lafayette, Oregon. I resigned 4 months into my term because the council refused to follow the law. Since then, I've been working to promote change to create a healthy local government. What is ethics? Simply stated, ethics refers to the standards of behavior that tell us how human beings ought to act in the many situations they find themselves as friends, parents, children, citizens, teachers, professionals, and public officials. 90% of all people follow the law 90% of the time. Those same 90% may complain about the laws they don't like, but will abide by them anyway. I am not here to determine who the 90% are. I'm here about the 10%. The 10% who do not follow the law, no matter what the occasion. Let's use the DUI law as an example. It states that as long as you don't exceed a blood alcohol level of 0.08%, you may not have violated the law. There is officer discretion when you are below that amount. If you show signs of impairment, the officer may arrest you, but it is a gray area. It may be challenged, and the charges may be dismissed. What if the law stated that you may not have any alcohol and drive? Then there would be no gray area. Then if you drink and an officer pulled you over, there would be no question of whether you have violated the law. You would be arrested. There would be consequences. A police officer receives a gift from someone. Later that week, he must pull that someone over for a violation. What influences the police officer's decision at that point? Is he influenced by the fact that he received a gift from the person or by the law? Does the officer have the right to use discretion? The gift has now tainted the officer's decision. Either way, now the decision is polluted. The same principle applies to ethics laws. If you state that a legislator can receive a present, a lunch, entertainment within the $25, $50 range, how much can you personally benefit before you're considered bought and paid for? How many lunches with the same person? The answer is none. If you're receiving anything because of your ability and influence, either directly or indirectly, a decision that benefits the giver, you have abused your position. What qualifies as a friend? Do you have to file a list of your friends on the ethics statement? If you continue to lessen the filing requirements, there's a good chance that you will all acquire a new set of friends. Are these friends you want to be affiliated with? Do you want your decisions tainted by gifts you receive? If someone has to take you to lunch to get your attention, then you should start inviting constituents. Keep in mind, these are not the people who just vote for you. So the next time you're invited to lunch, call me. I'm available.
Okay. Mr. Flood, I'll give you another 4 minutes, but if you read this, we'll be here about 20 minutes.
It's actually about 7 minutes long.
Okay. But we're on.
We have some of the 10% in our town of Lafayette. We have two council members that provided false information on their ethics statements. One counselor violated CCB law. The same counselor also violates city ordinances. Currently, the Ethics Commission is reviewing violations against state law. The CCB has already fined him. Our city administrator, who receives her evaluation from these council members, has told the sheriff not to enforce the local code. They will not prosecute him for an ordinance violation. There is nothing the citizens can do about it. We have a city employee who destroyed public documents. District attorney refuses to press charges, claiming she didn't know any better. Ignorance is not an excuse. These are examples of discretion being used against the 90%. When the decision is left to the people who benefit from not having the law enforced, the 10% will choose to preserve those that protect them from prosecution. You have a mixture of ethic changes being considered this session. Everything from expanding gift allowances to excluding family members who benefit from legislators' decisions to opting out of reporting at all. All these officials involved are at risk of benefiting from their position. People who have taken an oath will protect public trust. When you change the rules to make them more lenient or non-existent with no serious consequences, you leave citizens with no choice to believe that it does no good to be involved, to believe that corruption is rampant and there is no honesty in government. It is a matter of perspective, isn't it? I mean, 90% of us would applaud the police officer for taking the drunk off the road and saving lives. The other 10% would be angry that he had been caught. If you put tough ethics laws in place with tough consequences and make them apply to all public officials, we will have some recourse at the local level. Create penalties that remove temptation. If these people thought they would lose their office for violating public trust, they would think harder about the actions they commit. You have a great opportunity here. You have an opportunity to prove that you're part of the 90%, to put the rules in place to weed out the 10%. If you do not make it a priority to prevent public officials from benefiting from their positions, you send a message saying it's okay to destroy the public trust that is placed in their hands. Send the message that being paid by tax dollars is a privilege to be cherished, not a trust to be abused. I leave you with these thoughts. From Thomas Paine, a long habit of not thinking a thing wrong gives it a superficial appearance of being right. Ralph Waldo Emerson, we aim above the mark to hit the mark. In closing, public service is a burden, an obligation, and a right. Make a commitment to be part of something bigger than your own interests. Create an ethics program that we can all be proud of. I thank you for your time and hope you will consider this information.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Flood. Questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for coming here today.
Thank you.
Janice Thompson.
Hello, Janice Thompson, Democracy Forum, Oregon. Zeroing in on just some of the amendments, the dash fives related to the personal friends and those. Again, obviously the intent of this is right on. You know, still concerned somewhat about enforceability. I think, you know, the best case scenario is that people would use this as intended. The worst case scenario is it could become a loophole. And so with that in mind, potentially ask the Ethics Commission for a report back on whether or not this, you know, worst case use of this, you know, starts to bear fruit. Definitely support.
One of the things, sorry to interrupt you. This room has a unique characteristic, and that is that even if cell phones are muted, they still affect the sound system. So if anyone has a cell phone that is on and muted, it needs to be completely turned off.
And okay. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If you have an iPhone, there's an airplane setting on the settings that works.
Wow.
But that's why we're getting the feedback right now. So please proceed.
I know one of the other issues in the previous hearing, I think, is addressed by Senate Bill or the Dash 17 amendments. Not supportive of the Dash 25 amendments, but do understand, you know, which is relates to the reporting, but do understand the budget implications that are resulting in the Dash 22.
Wait, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Are you talking about the 25s or the 22s?
Both. The Dash 25.
I can clarify. Yeah, there are two amendments dealing with the same issues.
Right.
Some came through the committee, some came through individuals.
So just, you know, stating opposition to the Dash 25s and an understanding of the delayed implementation that's in the Dash 22s. In terms of the Dash 20s, about the eliminating the quarterly reporting or shifting that, to adding that to the annual SEI, that was actually something that I tossed out as an option the last time around. I'm concerned with that, however, if the Dash 24s or the Dash 26s move forward. I mean, basically, the rationale for my tossing out the option earlier of moving those quarterly reports to an annual and kind of having it be embedded in the SEI process for those folks who had to that subset of SEI filers who had to file those was that there was not a lot being reported. Those are kind of picking up, you know, the trips or things that are kind of exceeding the gift limits. And so if you kind of start to open up more holes in the gift limits, more stuff is going to be reported, then it gets to be more of a problem if the reporting is annual and you kind of, you know, this is again some of the discussions about, you know, timeliness and whatnot. So I just want to identify how those interact.
Okay.
In terms of the Dash 26s, I understand that that's kind of a moving target. And so, I'm not quite sure where that's going to end up. But I did want to at least give you some background of some of the 2007 discussion on this front. The specific example that came up was the possibility of a group like the Chalkboard Project wanting to send some public officials to some place, you know, to see some innovative school program. And that there was some interest, just like, you know, there were some allowances for fact-finding missions and these kinds of trips, you know, that there was some recognition. I think it's fair to say that one of the interests in this was to ratchet down on the trips, but to not, you know, completely shut it down completely. And so this nonprofit, you know, the example that came up really was related to the Chalkboard Project. So I'm a little troubled by extending out of the C3s into the C4s, which are much more explicitly, you know, political groups. Now, I think I'm hearing that that's not going to happen. That's why I hear that there's some moving targetness to this. So
there's already an amendment.
Okay, that's what I thought.
To narrow it back to C3s.
Yeah, but back to the C3s, so I think that's, you know, the right direction there. But the other, just FYI, is, you know, the background on this whole 5% is that, again, you know, some of this discussion about trips was obviously informed by the unreported trips that were paid for by the beer and wine industry. So there was some discussion about, well, any industry like that could set up a C3, and it would be a perfectly valid C3, and could just, you know, use this C3 allowance, option as a way to kind of keep up these trips. And so the 5% was in there to try to, you know, address, to keep the C3 option available for those organizations where most C3s do get most of their money from foundations and individual supports. So that is just the background on that. My understanding is that the 5% is running into, like, administrative concerns. I guess to the extent that was discussed, the thought was, is if the group wanted to do this, they would provide the necessary documentation, and it was not something that the Ethics Commission had to track down. So in general, I think where you're headed with this, you know, backing off, you know, that the 26 is headed in the right direction, but it is just starting to, I just want to really identify the public perception issue I think you're creating for yourself with kind of looking, you know, like more trips are going to come into play. I think that public perception issue also really influences what you want to do with the Dash 24s. I mean, again, when I was here before, I testified in support of doing away with the outright ban on entertainment. I see the Dash 24s as, you know, going beyond that, and actually kind of going back to some of the, not quite at the same dollar amounts as had been in place before, but going back to what Ron Burson's predecessor, Pat Hearn, used to call the Blazers exemption. So again, from a public perception point of view, I don't think that's the direction you want to be going in.
Go ahead.
So, and actually a former colleague of yours, then-Senator Deckert, in a 2000 article from the Register Guard, was asked about trips, you know, kind of Blazers games and whatnot, and as he put it, you know, he really didn't feel, and I think this is true, and it's good that we're in this situation, that, you know, a lot, you know, gratuities are not influencing a vote, but that he described himself becoming increasingly uneasy about the gifts, has stopped accepting them. And his quote then in this article was, if I spend a good portion of my time with one group of people, people able to give to a political campaign, then I'm not getting a full flavor of the whole community. And in some way, we set up our entire system to work that way, and it needs to be changed. So in the context of gifts, I think Senate Bill 10, you know, as was announced at the beginning of the 2007 session, it's a letter by Senate President Courtney, was like, you know, we're shifting gears. And so I'm just want to identify my opposition to the Dash 24s and 26 in terms of kind of retreating from that, and also just to identify, you know, the quote in the quote from then Senator Deckert, you know, the need to do the, I think in this case, you know, move the bulk of Senate 30 with it, all its amendments, especially related to the SEIs, and then identify that the bigger next steps, as alluded to by former Senator Deckert, are to deal with campaign finance reform and use of campaign funds.
Okay. I did want to alert you to one thing. If it's not available, it should be available shortly. I don't think it's out there. When you get a chance, or if you want to request it tomorrow, we have a Dash 30,
yeah,
which is actually the replacement for, it's will be the replacement for 24.
Okay.
Or it's, yeah.
I'll definitely look at it.
Or it'll be out soon.
Okay. I mean, I think what I would prefer on instead of the Dash 24s, I'll take a look at that, is just, you know, factor entertainment under the gift limit,
yeah,
as it is $50. So,
okay,
there you go.
Thank you very much, Scott Winkles.
Mr. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Scott Winkles, representing the League of Oregon Cities, appearing in support of Senate Bill 30. Before I provide comments on some of the amendments, I would simply like to sit on the record and take this opportunity to express the gratitude of the elected and appointed city leaders, as well as the city managers, employees, volunteers, and other folks that are subject to the Oregon's ethics statutes that are serving Oregon's city residents across the state. When the League of Oregon Cities started out on the ethics reform journey that we've all been on for the last 18 months or so, our goal was to develop an ethics policy that was just, treated local officials fairly, and protected the public interests. The Senate Bill 30 and the amendments under consideration, I think, are giant leaps forward in that endeavor, and we would like to applaud the committee for that, for being willing to go undertake this difficult task. As to the amendments, I won't go through each one owing to times, but I would start out with taking a look at the Dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 30. This is the friendship exemption. I'd like to point out that this is most states and federal ethics policies do have some form of a personal relationship or friendship exemption. I know there's one in the U.S. Senate. This one is similar to what's in the New Mexico ethics statutes. And it's very important for city leaders, particularly in smaller communities in the state, where you're interacting with it. Essentially, what it allows you to do is have both city leaders to have a normal social interactions that would previously have been prohibited under the old statute. Looking at the Dash 10 amendments as well as the Dash 414, the 10s rely on allows a public official to rely on the advisory opinion from the commission, and they would only be sanctioned by a letter of education if that advice acted in good faith and that advice turned out to be faulty. I think this in the 14s would hold a public official harmless for a good faith reliance on the manual for public officials. One of the major concerns that Oregon city leaders have had with some of the new laws was the uncertainty and the confusion in some of the language, and being able to have documents or being able to go and get advice and know that if you were honest and you provided all the salient details, that you would be held harmless is incredibly important. It has, besides just the public policy implications, it provides some emotional security to Oregon's public officials as they move forward in dealing with these new laws. The last amendment that I would touch on briefly would be the next amendment would be Senate Bill, the Dash 20s, which eliminate the quarterly reports. Far and above, the most complaints that city leaders have had are the quarterly reports. Most of my members simply don't have anything to report. Failing to file the report exposes them to sanctions. I've heard from several city leaders that travel out of the country regularly on business. They're concerned. I get calls after the deadline from people panicked that couldn't file the reports. This is very important for the League of Oregon Cities in moving forward. And last amendment I would touch on is the eliminates the Dash 24s, which eliminate the entertainment ban and bring the cap up to $100 aggregate per incident. As a former federal employee, I lived under a $50 per incident, $100 aggregate cap for 5 years. I was doing earmarks for a member of Congress. We regularly received invitations to gifts. This is doable. From my perspective, what a $50 limit cap and the $100 aggregate does is it keeps you from having to be rude, so that you can go to an event and you don't have to get into an awkward situation where you turn down something simple that you would not normally consider to be a gift or something of value, but would fall into the classification of the gift law, and still do your job and still interact with the constituencies you're dealing with. So I think that's very important, and as you heard earlier testimony, there are a number of cities that take active roles in supporting the arts in their communities, and they'd like to go and see how that support is impacting them. So the lifting of the gift ban is something that we would be strongly in support of, and with that I would be happy to take questions.
Any questions from Mr. Winkles? Seeing none, thank you very much for coming here today. Mr. Burson. Thank you very much for being here today, Mr. Burson. You are one of the parties that actually, I mean, we all will live under whatever changes are made to the law, but you're the one that has to basically administer the agency for the foreseeable future.
Thank you. And for the record, my name is Ron Burson. I'm the executive director for the Oregon Government Ethics Commission, and I appreciate you folks being here, too. I know it's a tough thing to do, and I'll try to be quick through my comments, and my comments are just going to, again, come from the perspective of the agency and maybe some questions I have in trying to administer these programs. So let me get my glasses out here. So on the 17, on the 30-17, the agency had actually put in a legislative concept that talked about reporting this, and this is an area that is not reported right now, and with this kind of increased allowance to go to these events, it might be something that we want to consider is looking at, yes, public officials can go to these events, receptions or meetings, accept admission, food and beverage, but report that previous to the changes in SB 10, these kind of events were reported if they broke a certain threshold. We could put a floor on that threshold, too, and still make that happen if they were over $50. It seems like $50 is kind of a theme that runs through a lot of the ethics laws, but it's something to consider. Under the 30-19 amendments, legislative administrative interest, nobody's, I guess, dared touch on this, but I just have a couple of comments on legislative administrative interest. From the agency's perspective, legislative administrative interest is the basis that all this works on. If there is no legislative administrative interest, there are no limits. And so we find this language to be essential for the agency to make a determination on gift acceptance. There was a change in here that it used to be that legislative administrative interest was in the subject to the action or vote of the person acting in the person's capacity, and the word action has been replaced with decision. I just want to inform the committee that many public officials don't make decisions. And so if they're not making a decision in their official capacity or making a vote, then they would not be subject to the gift limits. Okay. And so
can I get a clarification on that? Because I think one of the reasons we made that decision was that action is a broader term than decision. Does action, I would think that this would apply to a city manager who has the authority to let a contract without council approval, because they would be making a decision. If it's action, is the person that's actually preparing that report, making the recommendation to the city council, then subject as a public official?
Chair Devlin, I think you're correct in that. But we have to remember that the person sometimes that are making the decision is also relying on the recommendation or the actions of the person below them to give them an informed decision. And so what I'm a little leery of is that a person that wants that contract could gift the person and not making the decision but simply making the recommendation to the city manager an unlimited amount, maybe influencing their decision. I say I'm just looking at how the agency would actually administer this program. And so,
but wouldn't under any circumstances any local official, whether they were had an administrative or legislative interest, that in any way would benefit financially would still be subject to the law.
Well, that brings up an interesting point, Chair Devlin. When Senate Bill 10 came about, it actually separated the idea of there's two laws out there. There's 244.020, which talks about the gifts, and there's 040, which is the use of office.
Yeah.
And so if it's not a gift, then it's not a use of office. And so if they don't have that legislative administrative interest, then we could not go forward on use of office. Yeah. I mean,
we'll,
if that's what you're
asking. We'll do some clarification, but what we were trying to get away from was the situation where the person that basically has no decision-making authority. Obviously, in our cases, we vote and have a decision-making authority, but other people have a decision-making authority. That's not really a vote. But that this would not get down to the point where you would actually be that any... Well, how am I going to say this? If a planning director is making a recommendation to a planning commission, and the commission is obviously subject. Now, you might go to the planning director and say that recommendation, but now the planner that has actually assisted in that, does it apply to him or her? Does it apply to the person that has gathered the data? I mean, what we're basically trying to do here is to focus on the people where we think is the actual public concern. And the public concern is actually the people that actually ultimately make decisions and what influences are you know, what influences are out there that are affecting those decisions.
Chair Devlin, I understand that this will narrow it down and you know, it would be difficult for me to answer who it's actually going to affect, but in the past we looked at the person's capacity, what their job title was, and the action that they took inside of that capacity. Now we would look at their capacity and the decision-making authority inside that capacity. Now, how that would change the decision, it's hard for me to say that. But I just wanted to point out the change and my concern over that. I did want to point out, though, under legislative administrative interest, there are other areas that the agency uses that term legislative administrative interest, and that is in the filing of statements of economic interest, the SEIs. And legislative administrative interest, further on in the amendment on page 11.
Still on dash 17.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm on 19, dash 19. Legislative administrative interest is tied to these three portions of the SEI. In underneath this legislative administrative interest, we go back to the government agency, which is the more broader interpretation. Now, I just looked at the dash 29 amendments, just as I picked them up here. And on line 15 of the dash 29, when we're talking about entertainment, we go back to a person who has a legislative administrative interest in the government agency and which the public official. So, again, on this amendment, I think we're back to this broader definition of legislative administrative interest. So I understand this is brand new, and you really haven't a chance to look at it, but I just wanted to point that out as I saw it earlier. So those were my comments on legislative administrative interest. Under the dash 21 amendments, this actually goes back to the way the SEIs were before the last change with the five most significant sources of income. And I understand we all had a difficult time kind of defining significant. There was some talk about creating a floor in there, and that's essentially what this bill does. The floor is at 10%, but it goes, you report income between 10 and 49%, and then 50% and above. the reason I bring it up is that that was probably one of the biggest questions we got from SEI filers at the agency. And, in fact, people were calling up having us do the math. And, you know, I was told there'd be no math. So it was always difficult for us to do that, you know, for folks, trying to tell them where their income was at. I mean, my suggestion is if we want the floor to be 10%, that we just have one category of income sources above 10%. Now, we had a small portion of SEI filers that have such a diverse set of income that they don't have any one source that's actually over 10%. They have lots of sources, but they're all under 10%. We rarely run into that. This isn't a big problem, but by dividing this up, it did create a lot of questions for people calling the agency, trying to fill out their statements of economic interest.
Yeah.
I just have a question about that.
Yeah.
Because that is an interesting issue, and one of the ones I tried to deal with in one of my amendments. But personally, I did prefer the old system. To me, that was very clear, you know, 10%, and then you can figure that out, and the 50%, and that it got to something. Because with the new change, significant, if you look it up in the dictionary, significant means momentous. And I look, you know, you look at different income and say, well, that's not momentous, but maybe it's for somebody else. You know, it may not be significant. So it's not income sources. It's, you know, it's not your five income sources. It's your five significant ones. And you use an example, if you're Phil Knight and you're a public official and you're making $50 million a year, and he gets $500,000 from something, that's one half of 1%. That's not a significant thing to disclose. For him, that's not a significant source because it's one half of 1%. And, you know, you kind of look back into the past, which was, well, how did we previously discuss this stuff? And, well, it was 10%. Well, one half of 1% is not significant. But for someone making $20,000 a year and they got $15,000, well, that's three-fourths of their income. That would be significant. And that's why I think the old system, at least, was a lot easier to you know, to navigate, because what's significant to one person's income is not significant to another person's income.
Chair Devlin, Senator Metzger, I agree with you. My only suggestion would be is just have the one category of income sources over 10% and not divide it out between the 10 and 49 and then 50 and above. And that also saves the agency some space on the actual form, sort of having two sections, one. But yeah. Again, I'm just kind of pointing out some issues I have with implementation. So, the electronic reporting system. I appreciate the -22 amendments. For the record, the funds that were set aside to build that system have been used for other purposes now. On the -23.
They're probably keeping a teacher in the classroom or caring for an elderly person.
I don't disagree with it. I appreciate the committee recognizing that I would not be able to build that system. On the -23, my only concern there is this usual and customary practice. It's going to be very difficult for the agency to define what is usual and customary practice in businesses. I mean, we're not obviously not the experts in different businesses, and so I would welcome any help in trying to put some type of, you know, brackets around that and helping define usual and customary.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Would it be helpful if we just took out the usual and customary and just said if it's in connection with the person's private business or their employment or position as a volunteer, and took out that usual and customary? Do you feel like anything would be lost by doing that?
Chair Devlin, Senator Burdick, I don't know. I'd have to actually think about that. My concern is that the agency would be the one that would define what usual and customary is, and if the committee would prefer the agency not to make that, you know, make that definition, then maybe we could take it out of there, and the people could tell us what it's in connection with their business. If it's in connection with their business, then it would pass.
I may be able to elaborate on that in a moment. So
okay, because okay. You know, I'm a consultant, and I don't even know what's usual and customary. I know when I get invited to do something with a client, I go, and I don't ask them whether that's their usual and customary thing that they do.
Okay. On the -25, all I would ask in there is to allow the agency, because the system that we were creating We were trying to create a system where if somebody wanted to have that public record, they would contact the agency electronically. They could fill out an electronic public records request, and that public records request, and then we could respond to that again electronically. We could send the information. I understand the hesitance to have folks have just unlimited access over the internet with no checks and balances there, but I think we can still create a checks and balances electronically as opposed to regular mail or handwritten type of things. We could still require all of the information that we want in the Dash 25 on a form electronically from the folks. I think enough has been said about the not-for-profits. And the last thing that I have is I haven't seen the 28, but I don't know if I've ever testified that I'm against additional officials on the SEI. But the gift exception for entertainment, the only concern I have is that it seems like everything else revolves around $50 in the allowance of gifts. And in this case, we're going to have $50 per occasion, per source, up to $100. And so that will probably take just a little more training for folks out there to understand that they're allowed $50 gift over here from this person. They're also allowed $50 on two occasions for entertainment, up to $100. So a total from that person in both gifts and entertainment could be up to $150, or I should say from each source in a calendar year.
Okay. On that last one, I will comment that there is a revision to that that would make the total no more than $100, actually, combined. I did want to comment a couple of these. The 10% is an interesting suggestion because we have debated this issue over and over and over again. You know that there is a House bill that has a $3,000 limit in it, or a $3,000 threshold. Some people thought $3,000 was too high of a threshold. The change in SB 10 said list your top five sources. That created problems because a lot of people didn't have five sources.
Well, it said significant sources.
Significant sources,
so
yeah.
Some people may have sources, but they may have only had one significant one.
Yeah. Then we went to 1,000, and some people had some problems with that. So basically, a lot of people commented that we weren't having that much problem with the old system. So I think, but I do take your suggestion well about the 10%. We'll look into that in terms of... and obviously, just from that standpoint, too, if it is Phil Knight, and I'm not trying to criticize Mr. Knight at all, but if it is Phil Knight, none of the previous limits would have gotten the $500,000. So you're not going to cover everyone. The usual and customary, this is a troubling area, because this issue came up when basically the chair decided to open the issue to trying to address some of the complexities around gifts. Not so much the amount, but the complexities. And there is a bill in the House. That bill may still be necessary because of the nature of it, on student teachers and dealing with this, the issue of gifts. We started to think about who else could be impacted by this. One that came up almost immediately, but not by that party, was a physician that receives pharmaceutical samples and then gives them out to patients. Is that a gift? Or is it just the normal course of operation of a physician? And to be honest with you, when we started thinking about these, we came up with 2, 3, 4, and we thought that giving the commission just a general standard was probably a better than trying to think of every possible scenario. We had a scenario of a person buying a combine where it might be relatively normal to be flown out to actually look at combines. There's just so many different scenarios, and we're just trying to address that area. The electronic, you were making reference to being able to submit and to being able to request electronically. Both of those would still require appropriation to the agency, right?
Yes, sir.
That you don't have.
Correct.
Now. Okay.
I just wanted to clarify that.
Yes. Any additional questions? Okay. Thank you very much. We have three more. Genoa Ingram. Can you push those mics apart a little bit?
I can. Does that do it?
Yes.
Great. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll be brief. I'm Genoa Ingram, representing Special Districts Association, the Oregon Volunteer Firefighters Association, and the Oregon Fire District Directors Association. I have taken the time to review each set of the amendments, and I just wanted to commend the committee for taking their evening to spend this way to improve the ethics statutes. I did summarize each one of the amendments with the exceptions of Dash 27, 28, and 29 and sent them out to my clients, and they were very favorably received. I've been working on this issue since about 2001. My files are probably about this big, and I know some of you have files that would easily match or overtake that. But I just want to say that every set of the amendments that I looked at is going in the right direction. I believe that they do bring some reasonableness and some certainty to the ethics statutes, and I just want to thank you. I don't want to take a lot of your time. I want to remain available to you as a resource and to continue in the direction that we're going, and I just want to say thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
I'm going to call up two people together. Ms. Pellegrino and Mr. Bishop. And Ms. Pellegrino, can you start off?
Yes. Yeah, she's really smart.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Martha Pellegrino with the City of Portland. I would like to echo some of the comments made that I certainly recognize the amount of work that this committee has put into taking a very close look at changes that need to be made to clarify the ethics laws, and these amendments are a testament to that. From the point of view of a very large public entity, it takes a lot of work to train and explain what the ethics law means, and some of the areas and issues that we raised in the previous public hearing, a number of these amendments address those issues. So thank you very much. I just want to briefly touch on a few of the amendments and reiterate a couple of issues. On the Dash 3 amendments, which goes back to the definition of public official, that proposes to delete the or otherwise requirement. We still haven't figured out what is an or otherwise. What I will say is that there may need to be some further clarification at some point. When it comes to private contractors and periodic volunteers, those sorts of people who are private citizens but, for example, coach basketball for a city league, we need to know. These people need to know whether or not the law applies to them on the outside. So that would be a very useful issue to take up at some point, but the deleting or otherwise certainly is a great start to that. The Dash 5 amendments on the friend exemption, it is something that it is the issue that most raises concern and consternation among people when we tend to do trainings. It is the thing that feels like it is most invasive to people's private lives apart from their positions as public officials, and I would agree with some comments that have been made that there are ways to put sideboards on that exception that would get at some of the concerns that have been raised, and a number of states have seemed to do that successfully. Skipping ahead to the Dash 17 amendments, that is the amendment that would exempt certain types of food and beverage and representing government. That's something that we're very supportive of. There are certain types of events that city officials and other public officials are expected to attend as part of their public office, community, charitable, and business events, and we think that is a great an important change to make. The issue on the in the Dash 19s addressing legislative administrative interest, some of the some of the issues that have been raised. I think this change, the way it's written, goes a long way toward clarifying this provision, creating the nexus in that you're really talking about the work that a public official does and something they have authority over makes it much easier for us to convey what that public official's responsibility is. There may be some more opportunity for clarification on this, and we'd be happy to work with this committee on coming up with language. The Dash 23s, which is the customary, usual and customary gift exemption for outside business and volunteer work, wanted to acknowledge that this committee also included volunteer activities as part of that, it's very helpful. What I would say is a couple of the words in here, in addition to the sort of usual and customary language, the word exclusively just stands out as being something that I'm not sure is necessary for this amendment to make it make sense. The City of Portland has submitted some language that also goes to the issue of whether it bears a relationship to the office. Bears no relationship may be a very high standard. Some language that we suggested is that if the recipient's not performing work as a public official and the work is not used, is not conducted with use of public resources, that may also get at the same issue without the ambiguity of exclusively and bearing a relationship. And I think those are actually just the amendments we want to address, so thank you very much, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Ms. Pellegrino? If you'll please stay. Mr. Bishop.
Thank you.
I think I might be able to get a debate between three attorneys here, and that's always fun.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, appearing on my own behalf, not on behalf of anyone else. I've given you a memorandum that transmits an advisory opinion that was received by the Catholic Club last August from the Ethics Commission. And the purpose of my testimony is to comment specifically about that advisory opinion on the issue of what constitutes a legislative or administrative interest. That seems to me is key throughout the ethics laws that you have. And although the term has been defined in Oregon law for some time as an economic interest distinct from that of the general public, what that means is not well understood and is not delineated in the law. The Ethics Commission's opinion explains what the Commission believes an economic interest constitutes. And in my testimony, I've given you the five examples that the Ethics Commission has used to identify what constitutes an economic interest. Three of those, the last three that are bulleted in my testimony, seem to me to raise questions about the use of language, because the Commission considers a business or any organization impacted by funding or regulations overseen by state or local government that necessarily that would be an economic interest. The Commission also says that any lobbyist, business, organization, state, or local agency that's seeking legislative action or could be impacted by legislative action has an economic interest. And the Commission says that any entity, public or private, that must seek funding or is regulated by a state or local agency has a distinct economic interest. The term has been in the law for a long time. What happened and what changed was that determination by the Ethics Commission last summer. They've substantially broadened, I believe, by their interpretation, what constitutes an economic interest. In my view, some of those go well beyond an economic interest, but that's the way the statute is being interpreted. If you agree with that interpretation, don't modify the definition of the term. If you disagree, though, I think you have to modify that definition, or else the Ethics Commission interpretation stands. That interpretation has the force of law. It is a formal advisory opinion of the Ethics Commission. And so I would ask you to look carefully at what the Ethics Commission believes constitutes a legislative or administrative interest. I think that the advisory opinion goes too far in stretching the words, in determining what constitutes an economic interest. And that's the thrust of my testimony. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Okay. Not to ask for an instantaneous legal opinion, but in the Dash 19s, which is one of the areas that we've modified legislative and administrative interest, and I would have a feeling that that modification may not fully address the issue that you're trying to present, but I do believe I should inform you that we've actually modified legislative and administrative interest.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that. I know there are modifications of that term that are being considered.
Yeah.
I tried not to focus on any specific amendment, and frankly, I got a little buried in the paper of trying to follow all of the amendments.
This is the final. This is the final amendment on legislative administrative interest.
The Dash 19.
The Dash 19s, but.
And what? I'm sorry. What page is that on?
It's on page five and six.
With regard specifically to that proposed change, I think it's an improvement over the current law. It still includes the phrase economic interest distinct from that of the general public. And by not changing that, I think you are ratifying the Commission's interpretation of economic interest. And again, their interpretation, I think, goes well beyond what the words mean, so that virtually everybody has an economic interest, certainly in anything regulated by state government. There is no longer something, as I read their interpretation, that would be distinct from that of the general public.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
While you're reading that, maybe I can comment, and I appreciate Mr. Bishop doing this because we emailed a little bit about this. And it is, I think, very interesting when we look at this, especially he mentioned the last three, but which should be accurate, but I was looking at the last two. Because if you have a legislative administrative interest means an economic interest distinct from the general public, then you have to figure what that does mean. And in this decision, for example, it says, any action, or for example, the interpretation, anything that could be impacted by legislative action, any business organization, state agency, would have a distinct economic interest. Well, everything impacts somebody. And the last one says, any entity, public or private, that seeks funding or is regulated by a state agency would have a distinct economic interest. Well, every business is regulated, for an market case, by the state. You know, if you own a bar, you're regulated by the OLCC. So if you're an employee of the bar, that's supposedly not a distinct economic interest. You're a teacher, you're an education, you receive funding. So I wouldn't, the problem with that, and I think, I appreciate Mr. Bishop, under that interpretation, you know, you just declare conflicts on every bill that would ever come up because everybody is regulated by the land use law or by something, but that certainly is not distinct from the general public. But the way this advisory opinion is written certainly seems to me that everything is subject to it. There's just nothing. There is no class exception like you have with the conflict laws. At least in the conflict laws, there's a class exception, and they define distinct, saying that you know if it's a class, if it affects all doctors, or it affects all lawyers, or it affects all landowners, then that's a class exception for the conflict. But here, there is no class exception. It just says if you receive money, you know. All the public agencies receive money, or if you're regulated by, and every business is regulated to some extent by some state agency, then basically everything is a legislative or administrative interest. I don't think that's what anybody intends to do.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Metzger, I agree with that. That's the concern I'm trying to express.
I don't want to put you in this position, Ms. Pellegrino, but... I kind of knew that this was coming in a sense. I do believe what we've done has improved and clarified. Um, I will probably just ask for legislative counsel to review some of the comments here today and to comment, because I think how I consider it is a little bit different in this, in the sense of, I'll just use a practical example. If I'm a developer and I'm trying to get a land use approval before a city council, I have a distinct economic interest different from the members, or different from the public, with the mayor and the members of the city council. That's pretty clear. But if I'm just a general member of the public, I'm not so sure I have that. I'm sure I don't have it, but I will ask for some clarification.
Well, can I ask a question, Mr. Bishop?
Yeah.
Would it be helpful if, based on this, is if in asking legislative counsel, because again, it's, at least it seems to be much more clear in the conflict laws of what economic interest is, because it defines the class of people that would, you know, if it's narrower than this, then it's, you know, it's distinct or not distinct. If we tried to apply some of the language of the conflict law to the definition that is distinct from the general public, you know, if it covers all inhabitants of the state or a class of citizens, it's all general, that would at least give us a better idea than the fact that anybody who is impacted by a state agency is much too broad. But I think we do have access. I mean, would this be the right track on that, Mr. Bishop, or not, is to try to use the existing language and try to massage that into this portion of the definition?
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, I think that would be appropriate to look at. My belief is that those provisions in the conflict of interest law are better defined and focused on the nature of the problems that they're trying to address. I don't think they're perfect, but I think they give a better regulatory approach than the current definition of economic interest, both in the class of interests affected and with regard to it, the phraseology in the conflict of interest laws that talks about private pecuniary interest. And it uses that phrase instead of economic interest. And economic interest, I think, is, at least in this law, very hard to tell what it means. So I think looking at the conflict of interest law, unless there is some reason that I'm not familiar with to have different words meaning the same things in two different statutes, but it seems to me paralleling and aligning that language would be appropriate.
What we will do is ask legislative counsel to look into this issue and report back to the committee fairly soon. But I understand that your testimony is actually not relative. It is relative to your comment about this change in the law here, but your concern is how you believe the Ethics Commission, in their formal opinion, has expanded this definition.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Pellegrino, do you care to step into this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure I'm going to wade into it in any great depth. I mean, what I will say is that the Portland City Attorney has given based on the information that has been put forth by the Ethics Commission in the Guide to Public Officials and Advisory Opinions, has construed the provision very broadly with people. I think what this provision does is create that nexus, so you're not talking about that sort of broad interpretation in the entire agency, because then you exponentially increase the breadth of what you're talking about. You're talking about the economic interest in an individual, which, again, can be construed very broadly. But I think that the change in this amendment is certainly a major improvement to address that issue. What I will say is if legislative counsel is going to take another look at it, one recommendation or at least one other thing to look at is that the language that suggests the person acting in the person's capacity as a public official might better be stated just as in a public official, since the definition of legislative administrative interest also applies to relatives and members of the household. It doesn't seem to make sense. It doesn't square there. So if legislative counsel is going to take another look, there may be an opportunity just to clarify that language so people can really understand who the law applies to.
Senator Farioli, did you?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, thanks. I'm going to hazard a guess that nothing I say will add any clarity to this discussion. But I do have a kind of a question here. From the discussion I've just heard, it seems that it would be possible for a legislator voting on the floor to have a protection from a conflict of interest issue by virtue of the fact that they're a member of a class, and yet might be in violation of the ethics provisions by virtue of the fact that they represent a public entity, perhaps in their employment. So you'd be declared, you know, without conflict for a vote that you're taking by perhaps rules that we operate under, and perhaps you would in fact have an ethics problem if the commission applied its rules. And I think it would behoove us to try to get to a place where conflict of interest and ethical violation have at least similar, if not identical, language attached, so that we don't have confusion about the class exemption in one case, which may not even exist in the other.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Farioli, if I may, I think that's correct. I would only add that in addition to the laws, there are the rules of the Legislative Assembly that you're also subject to. And so there are requirements in your rules about what is appropriate in terms of gifts, activities, and conflicts of interest and how you disclose those. There's a question, a legal question about which is a higher authority for you. And some people think that actually your rules supersede state law, but that's not altogether clear.
Mr. Chair, if I can continue. I agree with Mr. Bishop, but what I was really referring to is you might have a question about an issue that would be adjudicated under the rules of the body and found, you know, one way, and then have a formal complaint filed with the commission, which would apply maybe a different standard of rules and come out with a completely different outcome. And that, to me, is troubling.
Mr. Chair, Senator Farioli, I think that's at least a theoretical possibility. Whether it's ever happened, I don't know.
Not to confuse this discussion any further.
And I apologize if I've contributed to that confusion.
But if you're going to relate this to conflict of interest and administrative and legislative interest, it appears to me that on the floor, does the member have a conflict of interest? And the question is, does the person have an administrative or legislative interest in the decision that's being made? And therefore, everything else, well, I'm going to really confuse this. The gift limit applies to a person with an administrative or legislative interest. It doesn't apply to the general public. I mean, your wife has no gift limit for you. Just don't have to worry about that. But I think I'm looking at this in two different directions. Because the administrative and legislative interest, maybe I'm confusing this more, but it when you read the language, it says, do you have a distinct economic interest in a person, or in, go back to 19, making, who can make a decision or have a vote. But I think it's looking at it in two different directions. But we can look at the conflict of interest language. I actually believe, not to add any more clarity to this, that members announce too many conflicts of interest that are not really conflicts of interest, that you know, that it has to be, they have to actually have an economic interest that would be harmed, or they would have to be benefited to actually have to announce the conflict of interest. So,
Mr. Chair, to Senator Metzger's point, there is also a class exemption. So if it's affecting the entire class the same, then you don't have a conflict. And I think oftentimes those class considerations may not be reflected when conflicts are announced.
Yeah.
That's probably true.
But that's the prerogative of the member, I suppose.
We quite often have that when we have I mean, we have a practicing physician, so, I mean, anything that applies generally for physicians, he's part of a class, a larger group, doesn't actually have to announce conflict of interest, maybe sometime does. We actually have attorneys, and so occasionally they will announce a conflict of interest having to do with the change in something relative to attorneys. We have it the same for dentists. That's still part of a group. I just think in general, I'm trying to relate this all back to that city councilor that has just been elected, who their only exposure they've ever had is a 10-minute class at a League of Oregon Cities conference, or a 20-minute class at Association of Oregon Counties, or a special districts conference. And they're trying to understand the law. So I need to get some more clarity in this.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Could I ask you to comment on the inclusion of candidates in here? The more I look at this, the more I, when you talk about training.
It has always been applied to candidates. We're just trying to make the law.
Well, the disclosure has been applied to candidates, but gift limits applied to candidates when, I mean, applying all these other provisions when there's really no avenue for training candidates?
That may be true, but the law has always applied to candidates.
Which law?
The SEI.
The SEI has, but I wasn't aware that other, thank heavens I wasn't, I probably broke it many times as a candidate.
Okay.
All the more reason for us to put that statute of limitations.
Okay. Anything else?
That would be a 5-second rule, Senator.
Yeah. Okay. With that, I don't think there's anything else today that's going to provide any greater clarity. But we will be meeting on Friday. There will probably be at least another opportunity on this bill, but there will be two more bills up actually simultaneously. It'll be at 10 a.m. on Friday, and that either by Friday or hopefully, if not by Friday, early next week, we will have a composite bill that brings all these amendments together, the ones that will go forward. Now, one thing I should explain, we thought it would actually help in terms of doing these amendments to keep the amendments to one or two issues so that people wouldn't have to look through a 40-page document and try to figure out what was changed this time or what was changed that time. To some degree, that's worked. To some degree, it's not worked in the sense of people are not seeing the composite picture of what all of this is doing. And I think when they see the composite picture, they will see it as an improvement. But then we will have that composite picture probably by Friday, if at the latest, early next week. And with that, we are adjourned. So 10 a.m. on Friday. And we'll be out by hopefully 11:30.